Testing 1, 2, 3. Dave Crippen, this is Bud Adams, finally getting around to sending what I promised you some time ago on the experiences and my reactions to the work environment in the early days of Ford's design department. I apologize for taking so long to get the material back to you, but it seems like we just had too much going on here in Arizona, and I couldn't get around to dictating, even though I did prepare an outline. What I'm enclosing with these tapes are various papers that I dug out of my old files here, and it includes a couple issues of the Craftsman newspaper published by the Ford Trade School back in 1937 and 38. It includes a couple of outdated resumes of mine that will give you some dates and other information if you need it. It includes a copy of some of the old material in my company personnel folder that I discovered at the time I retired in 1981. And this should prove interesting to you because it gives the wage level of a lot of people in the design department at that time who were fortunate enough to get 5 or 10 cent an hour raises. And some of the names might clue you into other people that you should contact and interview. One of the amusing things I found, and which I'm including, is a trade school bulletin board notice that I prepared for an alumni club dance. And this shows that at the time I was in the trade school, I was interested in lettering and had the old speedball pins practicing their alphabets in the speedball booklets, and was doing things of this kind for the trade school, including preparing a diploma for the trade school, which they never had previously. The amusing thing about this bulletin board notice is that you could go to an alumni dance at the old Grandy Ballroom at that time for 25 cents a person. How about that? To give you an idea of how I've organized this material, the first section here will be on my personal background and career highlights, as you had requested. The second part would be some comments on the working environment in the engineering lab and the old design department in the years 1937 to 1942. The third section will be some comments on the people, the design department staff, during those same years of 1937 to 42. And the old Craftsman newspapers that I've included will provide information on the trade school graduates that were actually in the design department at that time. The fourth section includes comments on the activities and the philosophy, if there could be said to be a philosophy, in the old design department 1937 to 42. The fifth section outlines some of my personal projects that I worked on during those years. The sixth section covers later experiences which touch on the design center activity in one way or another. The seventh part puts down some thoughts that I would like to give you on automotive design, or for that matter, any product design and development activity. And these stem from not only my time close to styling, but my later years in engineering there at Ford as well. The eighth and last section covers some concluding remarks on what I feel that the Ford Design Center has contributed to the auto industry as a whole. I hope this organization of material meets with your requirements, and that these low-priced cassettes that I'm using are adequate for you to pick up on your playback equipment. So without further apologies, let's start on section number one, my personal background and some career highlights. My father was a toolmaker at Ford, and he died when I was 12 years old. My mother got me an interview by means of contacting my dad's old superintendent, an interview to possibly get into the Ford Trade School, and the records indicate that his help was resulted in me enrolling in the trade school on February the 25th, 1932, which you will recall was at the depth of the famous Depression. I went through the Ford Trade School and graduated in 1935, and as a senior, so-called, took all the apprentice school courses while doing tool design and machine design work in the trade school. Now, a senior was a trade school graduate who was not yet 18 years old and thereby couldn't be given a full-time job in Ford Motor Company. So what was done was a lot of the seniors that were, a lot of the graduates that were still young were given full-time jobs in the trade school itself, no more classroom work, and we did work for the company actually on work orders that were sent over to the trade school. Then I was sent to Gate 4, where the tool design activity was, and after a short period, I think about 3 weeks, I was notified that I was to go over to this design department in 1937 at the engineering lab with another trade school boy named Emmett O'Rear. And we actually, Emmett and I actually arrived a week or so after John Nager was sent there, who came from the Ford Training School at Gate 4. This training school, as John has probably told you, was another school that Mr. Ford established for high school graduates, teaching them how to operate toolroom machinery and so on. And at about this same time, in I guess it was September 1937, I was lucky enough to win a 5-year tuition scholarship to the Lawrence Institute of Technology. What Lawrence Tech did was to award such a scholarship annually to a trade school graduate. This is covered in one of the items in the Craftsman newspaper that you have. So I was going to Lawrence Tech evenings, three nights a week, working in the design department during the day. I was going steady with a girl in North Detroit, about a mile from Lawrence Tech. And in 1940, I actually was also taking flying lessons through the U.S. government civilian pilot training program there at Lawrence Tech, and getting my private license. As a matter of interest, I only flew 5 hours after I got my license because I couldn't afford to buy my own flight time then. And looking back, I wondered how in the hell I ever had all the energy to keep everything going. But it was an interesting, busy time. Then, evidently, the cheap labor that the design department obtained from the trade school to help out with clay modeling and other design work was not too badly received, because in March of 39, again referring to the old Craftsman newspaper, five additional trade school grads were working in the design department. And these names also might permit you to contact them and get their reactions as well. I graduated from Lawrence Tech with a mechanical engineering degree, a bachelor's degree in 1942. And at this time, anyone working in the design department or anyone doing drafting activity or who could do engineering work at all was put on war projects. This amounted to the early B-24 drafting work, and I remember I drew up all the pieces of tubing that were necessary to be cut certain ways and have their ends shaped certain ways so they could be welded together as an engine mount assembly. And there was a rangefinder project and several other things that Ford was working on at that time. Well, I'd been coached by some of the older designers there in the design department, like Johnny Walder, who was always a pretty salty character, that if you were worth your salt at all, you didn't stay at one company, you floated around and got a higher salary and advanced every time you moved to a different company in the industry. So, as a result, I left Ford in June of 42 for a salary amount which Ford couldn't match. At least that's what old Joe Galam, the chief body engineer, told me. And I went to Briggs Manufacturing Company as an engine designer on a military contract that they held covering the British Aspen engine patents. I had met a couple of the fellas there at night school at Lawrence, and also in the student activity of the Society of Automotive Engineers, and they made me aware of this opportunity and arranged for the interview. A little farther on, 1944, of course, the war was moving on, and because of my training and the fact that I was supporting my mother, the draft authorities were not breathing down my neck real hard. But I got the urge to join up because my mother had secured a job as a file clerk in the downtown U.S. Army Ordnance Office, and said that she was okay and she's able to take care of herself, which was true at that time. I wanted to get into Navy flying, but at that time Every flight school they had was filled up, and the officer at the examining center there recommended I take a direct commission as an ordnance officer, an ensign, in the Naval Reserve. This I did and went off to school in May of 1944. I came home on leave in at the end of July of 44 to marry Claire Block, who was one of the few girls in the engineering lab building secretarial pool, which was upstairs. I got out of the Navy in June of 46 and was released from duty down in Jacksonville. And when I came back, why, I scouted around for a job and ended up interviewing with Joe Feltz, whom I had met during the war work period at Ford and who was now Lincoln Mercury chassis supervisor. He hired me to work on the board doing suspension design work. And from that time, I worked in the car engineering end of things pretty much, except I was brought over to special military vehicles operations from 1961 to 63, which was extremely interesting military development work. And we did the turret design for the Shillelagh weapon system. We worked on gun development, which I don't think you and a lot of other people realize. We had a couple of firing ranges at the Rouge plant underground where weapons were developed for the Springfield Armory at that time. And following that, I went into chassis engineering. Then I went over to Ford of Europe as chief chassis engineer from 1971 to 74, which was a terrific experience. And then came back, and from that time till my retirement in March of 1981, I was in chassis engineering. I always considered my retirement as my personal contribution to the cost reduction effort, because I retired at 62 instead of hanging around to the decrepit old age of 66. My styling contacts were intermittent and irregular from 1946 to 81, consisting of feasibility and functional guidance on chassis components such as wheels, wheel covers, steering wheels, air conditioning and radio packaging, brake pedal and pedal pad design, accelerator design, parking brakes, and so on. One contribution I did make early on, working for Joe Feltz in about 1947, that could be considered basic, was that I devised a method of laying out and identifying the various controlling geometry points for the front suspension, which together with the tire dimensions would define the so-called tire envelope as the front wheel went through its jounce and rebound and steering motions. And what this did was permit the stylus to create a front fender cut line that would not interfere with the tire. And this, of course, with modern developments has been elaborated upon and been computerized for quite some time. But it was something that related to the styling of the product. My pre-war styling work, 37 to 42, gave me an appreciation for the designer's attitudes and objectives in his problem, so that I was able to encourage an attitude of willing cooperation in my engineers who were working with the Design Center on new programs. One of the last projects along this line was our development in Ford of Europe of the first high-production styled cast aluminum wheel for the Capri 2. This was a classic example of what can be done to create an exciting new product on time with reliable function when the stylist, the engineer, and a respected qualified supplier all work together. My design department time, 37 to 42, I consider the most satisfying work experience I ever had. I hope your stop button is working satisfactorily, Dave, and I'm not dictating too fast so that you can isolate the material you're really interested in and sort it out from the trash. But let's go on section number two, which are some comments on the working environment in the design department at the old engineering lab, circa 1937 to 42. First of all, there was no smoking. Henry Ford number one, of course. And of course, there were no coffee or candy machines any place on the property. The only girls you ever saw were those from the secretarial pool on the second floor, either going to or returning from lunch, or in the cafeteria itself if you happen to be there at the same time. There were only a couple of, quote, older girls downstairs. One was the main phone operator, and there was a secretary or two for people in the mahogany row along the front of the building. Plus Rachel McDonald, the librarian on the second floor, and she was one hell of a fine person and highly thought of in her profession. I think she was the president of the Industrial Library Association or something of that kind. And but that was it as far as females were concerned. There were none on the main floor where the working people could see them, be inspired, or bother them. Henry Ford number one came through the lab center door from the parking lot area frequently. And if you happen to be around going to lunch or coming back or something like that, he always said hello in passing through the center doors if he happened to encounter you. This was the polished teak herringbone floor that was always polished. I think the guy worked at it from one end to the other full time. This was in the center area of the lab building, the long ways of the building. Now there were two desks at the center with chairs, and these were for visitors. And this was as far as a visitor was allowed to penetrate the engineering area at that time. If a person, usually a supervisor, had an appointment with someone from the outside, why, the receptionist at the front desk would okay them to go in, and they would sit at one of these two desks, and the engineer or supervisor that had the appointment would have to come up to the desk and sit there and cover their business at that spot. There was no wandering around between the drawing boards and the engineer's desks, as is so common today. There was an activity in the basement of the engineering lab where Johansson gauge blocks were manufactured. I never went down and saw this myself, but these gauge blocks were something that Henry Ford number one had gotten the rights on, I guess, from Sweden, and were the industry base for dimensional accuracy. They're still referred to as Joe Blocks in the industry today, although I believe several other companies manufacture them. And they're really the foundation of highly accurate interchangeable part manufacture in all fields, as well as automotive. And one of the other offices that used to be on the first floor near the aisleway that led out to the center reception area was Mr. Ford's watch repair man. And there were always a lot of watches and a few clocks hanging inside his glass-walled office there. The office partitions in the engineering area and the partitions that surrounded the design department were golden oak with obscured glass in the upper partition area. And the old design department was located at the southwest corner, enclosed by these golden oak partitions. I've seen Henry Ford number one walk into the design department while I was working on a clay model at the one end there. He'd walk in just a few feet and sort of look around and lightly shake his head like, boy, he didn't understand this particularly, and then he'd walk out again. And one of the other interesting personal observations I had was that of Harry Ferguson over from England or Ireland. And he was in there himself for a number of days working on a clay model of the radiator grill and top tank enclosure for the what became the Ford Ferguson tractor. And the thing that attracted me was he had taken off his suit jacket and rolled up his sleeves, and this exposed his suspenders. And these were the most beautiful pair of all leather suspenders that I had ever seen up to that time. I was sort of used to the cheapy striped elastic variety that United Shirt Company used to sell, and I'd never seen a first-class English leather set of galluses supporting a pair of heavy tweed pants before, but they were really pretty. And Henry Ford, number one, used to come in and consult with Harry Ferguson over this particular model. Also on the first floor of the engineering lab, down toward the cafeteria end, which would be, I guess, the north end, north end, was a print shop and a machine shop also. And there used to be like a morgue of older concept chassis and engines at this north end, including a five-cylinder inline engine. I don't think the thing ever ran very well, but one of the Bryant boys, I think, was working on that particular five-cylinder engine project. Now, the design department initially had modeling bridges, and I think you know what a bridge is. Anyway, these first ones were made out of wood, and they were a nice pattern-making grade mahogany, and the bridge would slide on rails. Push them and kick them to get them into position along the side rails, and then wedge them into position so they wouldn't move while you were taking measurements. And at the time, I came in there in 1937 with Emmett O'Rear, these modeling bridges were being replaced by aluminum and steel designs, which were created by Bill Wagner, Willis P. Wagner. And we still had one-tenth size bridges and little platforms around which were still wood. One thing that was nice about working at the engineering lab then was in the wintertime, the twin ponds in front would, the twin lakes, would freeze over. And I used to get to work early and take my ice skates and skate around in front all by myself in a beautiful dawn light there on real smooth ice until it was time to come in and begin work. One of these twin lakes, as you know, has been buried just a few years ago to add parking area to the engine and electrical engineering activity. The boss of the design department was E.T. Gregory. His nickname was Bob, and he was a beady-eyed redhead that was going bald with a straggly mustache. And I can remember that he always wore his pants cuffs very high, exposing some sock above his shoes. And in wintertime, he would show up with a raccoon coat on there. And we boys that were working there then figured that he was the tightest tightwad in the world with pay. And the other thing was I made several tenth-size clay models based on concept sketches that Bob Gregory had produced. And I'd have to say that Gregory had a talent for drawing stuff on paper that absolutely couldn't be made in three dimensions. However, he, looking back, he's not all that bad a person, and a lot of these tent-size models did turn out to be concepts that Edsel Ford approved for development of full-size designs later on. So this, again, was one of the good experiences that I look back toward. Now, the designers that were, quotes, on the board at that time were John Walter, a fellow named Walter Crook. Walter Crook, as I recall, was a graduate of the Yale School of Fine Arts, and he had been at Yale at the time of Rudy Vallee, and was actually a competitor of Rudy's when Walt Crook had organized his own band and was attempting to make his way in the music world. As I recall, Crook failed, and in order to pay off his obligations, took a job on a Ford Lake Freighter and ultimately ended up there in the design department. Another fellow I've mentioned before is Bill Wagner, who had retired a number of years ago out to Tiburon in California. I don't know whether he's still living or not, but he was a very gentlemanly, calm, scholarly type of fellow that, again, did just about anything that had to be done. Excuse me. The head clay modeler, to whom Emmett O'Rear and I were more or less apprenticed to begin with, was named Dick Benike. There was a shop boss named Jimmy Lynch. Jim had previously worked at the Ford Aircraft activity when they were building tri-motors there in Dearborn. And there were a couple of pattern makers and carpenters, Jimmy Mearns and Jack something or other. I can't remember Jack's name, but they were, Jimmy Mearns was a 100% Scotchman, and Jack, I think, was either Scotch or English. At that time, the clay we were using for clay models was a gray type clay, and it was soft when warm and would set up after being modeled in place so that you could smooth it with various tools and actually paint it. The clay that's used today, I think, is a superior variety, and it's sort of a tan terracotta in color. But at that time, the clay shavings and pieces of clay blocks that were virgin pieces were softened in ovens in aluminum trays in these ovens that were heated by light bulbs. And this for oven arrangement with the light bulbs was a in-house design and manufacture there at Ford. And when you wanted to get some clay, you'd go over to the oven and pull out a drawer and grab a glob of this stuff. Hopefully it wasn't too hot so that it overheated your fingers, but you'd take that back to your model and proceed to rub it in place. And you could keep this gray clay, a portion of it, in your one hand to keep it warm enough so that you could take off a little bit at a time and apply it to the model. The clay modeling tools were largely made on site based on the sculpture and modeling tools that Dick Benike had from the old country, from his trade as a industrial sculptor. And occasionally the design department shop would have some handles turned up and bend some spring wire for tools and sharpen them and provide them for the rest of us that were working on clay models. The painter that I remember came in, I don't know, somewhere around 1939 or something like that, and he was named Gar Evans. He was a little guy, and we all used to help out on the painting of a clay, small clay model or something like an instrument panel, and Gar would show us how to modulate the pressure of the spray gun and spray the primer on, and then we would proceed to sand it and smooth it out and so on. We had a sweeper that was pretty much busy all the time, keeping the floor free of small bits of clay, and his name, I think, was Jay Haskins, and I believe he became a clay modeler later on. But anyhow, the real first success for the design department, which I was told ensured its success with Henry with Edsel Ford, was the facelift job for the 1938 Zephyr, the front end and grill primarily, and hood. And I don't think there was too much change, 37 to 38, on the rear end. But the Zephyr in production at that time was Briggs' creation. I think a man named John Jarda did the 37, the Zephyr that was in production in 37. And it was quite a radical appearing car, and
Gregory and his very small staff at that time got the job of designing a what we would call a major facelift today, a new grille, new front fenders, new hood, and so on. And that was a pretty car because the contours of the front fenders flowed down between the headlights and the center of the grille, flowed in a soft curve down to the behind the bumper, and was sort of patterned after the low graceful grills that some of the European like Mercedes-Benz race cars had at the time. And things sort of went on from that 38 Zephyr success. One nice thing about the design department work at that time was that you could do almost all of the steps in a project yourself. An example is if I were assigned to work on an instrument panel model, why we could run across the hall to body engineering and pick up the intended line of the windshield and the width of between the A pillars and come back and help the carpenter build a mock-up and design the darn mock-up as far as that's concerned. And then you could make your plastic templates from the drawing you had made yourself and proceed to clay up this suggested instrument panel. And this is assuming you'd gotten some sort of okay to go that way based on a drawing that you would have made. And then when the clay model was smooth and finished, why, you might even help Gar Evans paint it and sand it down and put the finish coats on it. Maybe cut out the lettering for the instruments and see something completed from beginning to end. I also, at that time, I think like a couple other guys, did design work at home because it was so interesting. I can remember bringing back some hubcap designs that I brought in for evaluation by these designers on the board that I mentioned previously, John Walters, Bill Wagner, and Walt Krook. And one idea I had was of combining the rear license plate on the deck lid with the trunk lid handle that you use to open the lid itself. And another thing that I helped conceive was the concealed running board that we put on the Zephyrs later on, I think starting in 39, but I'm not real sure of that. Anyway, it covered up the part of the exposed rubber running board and gave body color from top to bottom. And we used to simulate chrome plate by rubbing aluminum foil over the clay extruded moldings or over the grill bars that we had cut in on the model ourselves and so on. I don't know whether they still use that technique today or not. I know this dictation probably sounds boring as hell with a monotone voice and so on. And I just hope that you can derive what you're looking for from it or from our little interview, assuming I get back to Dearborn one of these days soon. But anyhow, let's go ahead with what I've indicated as section 3. which are some comments on the design department staff members in this 1937 to 42 period. Now, I've already, in this previous discussion, talked about some of the people, and this section will supplement comments I made on them earlier. At that time, there was Johnny Nager, myself, and Emmett O'Rear, brought over as chief help from the trade school to help with the clay modeling. And I am kind of joking because it was a unusual opportunity, but we were making 65 cents an hour as trade school seniors when we came over. And later, the more trade school boys were sent over, and this included Benny Barbera, and more designers were hired in to the activity as Edsel Ford expanded the Ford design responsibilities and brought in more product programs, you might say. There was Bruno Colt, who was a sculptor, I would say, primarily. He did a lot of nice work in clay and in wax. There was Ross Cousins, who was an illustrator, did excellent work with the airbrush. There was a young man called John Hayes that worked in the, Johnny Hay, I think it was, who worked in the shop, and he got his job by sending in a model car he made out of tin cans and other scrap metal, which was just a marvel of workmanship. And I think when the Ford people saw that, why, they figured they knew where he'd belong. So John Hay came in, and then Martin Rogitko came in, and he was an outstanding body designer and body engineer that came from one of the East Coast coach building outfits. And God, Martin Rogitko, we just admired him so much. And he, I think before he retired, created a body drafting course and a textbook, which I wish the hell I had a copy of, frankly. Then Dick Benike, whom I mentioned was head clay modeler. And I remember after we were there a short time and we had been assigned to put clay on one of these full-size models and were just getting the first idea of maybe what the shape of the darn fender and what the car should be, why, I remember asking Benike, old Dick, the old German with the long upper lip, how do you tell when you've got a good shape, or how do you tell when you've got a good line? In other words, what's the guiding principle here? And he sort of rolled his tongue around for a while and mumbled, and then he says, well, what you do is you put on what isn't enough and take off what's too much. So that's about the guidance that we had, and really his answer wasn't too bad. You have to pick up the feel of that activity by actually doing it and having some sharp eyes of yourself, I guess. Now, when Martin Rogitko came in the first time, here's another, I don't know what Martin was or what Rogitko is, whether he's Hungarian or whatever, but he was a European anyway. And I remember Dick Benike's reaction to him when Rogitko first came in. Martin had an arm full of thick plastic curves under his arm when he first came in the place, and he took them over to his board, and Dick and I and several others looked at those curves he had, and they were so damned old-fashioned. They were like the letter L boomerangs, and they had a sharp radius at the corner of the L and were evidently what Martin used regularly back east when he was doing old body design, custom body design work back there, where the roof came over rather flat and made a sharp turn and rather vertically came down the side of the body. And old Dick looked at me and sort of chuckled about the fact that these curves were very old-fashioned. Well, you can't keep a guy like Rudgitko in the dark very long. It was only a couple days later he had a vise attached to his drawing board and a file, and he was at lunchtime filing each one of these curves to suit the shapes that we were working with at that time. And we were pioneering, you might say, the more rounded roof and the angled tumble home from there on down to the side of the body and generous curves. And he reworked that whole family of curves until he had a new family of curves that suited the type of shapes that we were working on. Now, Benike's no longer living, but his son graduated, I think, from UAD as an architect. And if you want to get some history on Dick Benike, perhaps his son is still in the area and you could talk to him. But as I remember, Benike came to the Detroit area in the heyday of the construction of the large movie palaces like the Michigan and the Fox downtown. And he was an industrial sculptor that learned his trade in Germany. And he told me about how over there, after you finished an apprenticeship and you became a journeyman, you had to leave your hometown for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. If you came back to your hometown again, it was a sign that you didn't have the stuff to make a living and you were a failure and you turned into a street sweeper or something. And anyway, he came over here as an industrial architectural sculptor. And then he, when the theaters were completed, I guess, anyway, he drifted into modeling work for Briggs, I believe. And from there, he was brought over to Ford. And I liked Dick very much. He was a typical, taciturn German fella, but I enjoyed him, and I think he felt friendly with me because he used to talk at lunchtime, and I learned a great deal from him. And he outlined a philosophy that I think prevailed on the clay models we were working on at that time. And this was that the shapes and the forms should be modeled versus being sculptured from a, say, a solid block, or being based on drawings that were made first, and then you go over and duplicate the drawings on the clay model. Dick's position was that you identify certain key points, like windshield points and the width of the body and where the radiator is going to go and things of that kind, but then you modeled and added clay in between there to get a softer feel to the form than you would if you had tried to draw it on paper first or carve it out of a block of mahogany or something and end up that way. And if you would look back to the General Motors products of those years, I think you'll find that General Motors has more of a stiff, hard architectural look to their cars than we did at Ford. The 38 Zephyr I mentioned, and then if you go to the 39 Mercury and other cars, why, ours were generally rounded and flowing and softer and not the stiff General Motors type of appearance. One incident that I remember is Dick Benacki used to subscribe to one of the German language newspapers published here in Detroit. And I don't remember the name of it, something or other, Zeitung. But the masthead of the paper had German black lettering, and there was a circle in the center which had the swastika in the middle of it. And one lunchtime, Dick was reading to me from the paper about the Hitler's program for the German people's car, the Volkswagen. And the scheme was they had coupon books, and they could go to their local bank or wherever, I guess, and buy stamps to stick in this book. And when the book was filled, they could turn it in and they would get their car. Of course, Hitler's other plans wiped out that one, and I don't know how many Germans got screwed on their coupon books, but this was what he read from the German newspaper. And of course, he thought that the Porsche design of the VW was quite an advanced piece of machinery, and at that time it sure as hell was. You can't argue with the bug being so popular for so long. One of the men around the engineering lab at that time was a guy whose last name was Becker, and he was head of payroll in the engineering lab, and he was the other guy that we thought was a super tightwad because raises were few and far between. But from today's perspective and experience, you don't know how much of a budget Edsel had for the design department and what instructions had been given to Becker and what his limitations were. But the two tightwads were Becker, the payroll guy, and Gregory, of course. And I don't know what limitations were on Bob Gregory. The so-called designers that I referred to, John Walter, Walt Krook, Bill Wagner, had star badges. And at that time, a star badge meant that you earned $250 a month or more. So being hard workers and good boys and doing our damnedest and whatever, our ambition was to hopefully one day get a star badge. And I know out in the Ford assembly plant or out in the Ford tool room or anything like that, a star badge meant that you wore a white shirt and a suit coat and everybody was afraid of you. It was quite a badge of authority, as well as indicating that you were at the higher levels of the salary payrolls. This Martin Rogitko was able to, as a custom body engineer and custom body builder, he was able to lay out the internal structure for a body, the door pillars and members around the windows and everything else internally for the structure of a body, as well as develop all of the exterior surfaces. So he was one terrific guy, and I remember him working on layouts for what became the Continental. And if you've ever looked at a body draft or a good body drawing, you know that it's one of the most complicated pieces of technical drafting that you can imagine. Lines overlay each other all over the place, and you have to know what you're looking for in order to find the piece that you're concerned with, or if I trace the line you're concerned with, and so on. And Martin really opened my eyes when